Welcome to Madang Podcast. Today's special guest is Dr. Kwok Pui Lan, who is a Dean's Professor of Systematic Theology and Special Advisor to the Dean for Strategic Changes at Candler School of Theology. In this episode, she shares her new book, The Anglican Tradition from a Postcolonial Perspective, and discusses the Anglican Church, forgiveness, women's ordination, Desmond Tutu, and so much more. Please stay tuned. For a decade, at the beginning of the 21st century, a small group of pastors, missionaries, and theologians set out to change the church. They were mostly Gen Xers, mostly men, mostly white, mostly evangelical. They planted churches and wrote books and ran conferences. Please join Emerge Podcast, a homebrewed Christianity production, a crowd-funded podcast to preserve an oral history of the emerging church movement. In this multi-part series launching January 2024, hosts Dr. Tony Jones and Dr. Trip Fuller will journey through the electrifying, tumultuous, ever-evolving years of the ECM through interviews, stories, and opinions from some of the movement's pivotal figures. There will be live-stream debriefs of the history, a private online community, and an emerging church movement library. Please join today. Go to www.tripfuller.com. Emory University's Candler School of Theology is offering a new certificate of inquiry with a series on Asian and Asian American Christianity. Join leading scholars Dr. Kwok Pui Lan, Dr. Maggie Lau, Dr. Suyam Park, Dr. Tao Seong Bianin Liu, and Reverend Mihi Kim Court as they explore Asian and Asian Christianity approaches to scripture and theology in this three-part series. All three courses, Asian and Asian American Feminist Biblical Studies, Asian and Asian American Study of Christianity, and Asian American Queer Theologies are being offered for $99, and scholarships are available for any interested participants. Please register at bit.ly/certificate of inquiry or email us at candlerfoundry@emory.edu with any questions or concerns. The mission of Faith and Community Empowerment is to empower faith community leaders to better serve underserved communities. FACE trains faith leaders, educates underserved communities, and provides advocacy so that the voiceless may have a voice. FACE started by helping the Korean American community. Hidden behind a model minority myth, the Korean American community is the most underserved ethnic community in Los Angeles. In 2016, FACE was invited to the White House in a discussion of how to empower faith communities to better reach out to underserved communities. FACE has expanded its programs to serve more communities, such as Hispanic community. Donations will help grow FACE programs to provide training, education, and advocacy. Please go to www.facela.org to donate.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com. This is Madang, an outdoor living room for guests to share their experiences and their work. I invite you to come in and stay for a while.
Welcome to Madang Podcast. Today's special guest is Dr. Kwok Pui Lan, who is Dean's Professor of Systematic Theology and Special Advisor to the Dean for Strategic Changes at Candler School of Theology. Kwok is a former William F. Cole Professor of Christian Theology and Spirituality at Episcopal Divinity School. Her research focuses on Asian feminist theology and postcolonial theology. She has written or edited 23 books in English and Chinese, including Postcolonial Politics and Theology and The Hong Kong Protests and Political. Her current research focuses on the practice of postcolonial theology. Today, she is on Madang Podcast to share her new book, The Anglican Tradition from a Postcolonial Perspective. Ian T. Douglas writes,
In the Anglican tradition, from a post-colonial perspective, Kwok Pui Lan calls us once again to move beyond the limits of Anglo-American hegemony in our understanding and experience of the global body of Christ known as Anglicanism. So using a post-colonial lens, drawing upon many diverse voices from around the world, she provides hope and understanding to the challenges and changes before the Anglican Communion today. So welcome to Madang Podcast, Pui Lan.
Thank you very much. I am so glad to show the audience this book, The Anglican Tradition. From
It is a beautiful book. You have a hardcover, I have a soft cover. I wish this cover was on my book because it's so beautiful and the book is just amazing.
Thank you
for coming on today. Before we get into the book, you know, I wanted to talk about other things because you are so busy. You know, you're writing and speaking and doing a lot of Zoom talks and podcast interviews. But you have you kind of began Pan Autumn, which is Pacific Asian North American Woman in Theology and Ministry. Can you say a little bit about that? Because I think that's how I first met you, and you've become a wonderful mentor for me and now a wonderful colleague in so many different ways. So please share with us what Pan Autumn is.
Thank you very much. When we started, it was a small group consisting of Asian women primarily studying theology in the northeast of the United States. At that time, most of us were doctoral students from Harvard, from Union, and Princeton. And so we wanted to form a group for mutual support. So we call ourselves Asian Women Theologians. And later, when more women joined the group, including our Asian American sisters, we then expanded the name. And so today, it is Pacific Asian, North American Asian Women in Theology and Ministry. And so at that time, I would not have imagined, I think none of us would have expected, that this little group will last this long. So from 1985, when we had our first national conference, we have been meeting each year. And during the pandemic years, we met virtually.
Oh, that's amazing. So, and you know, it's expanded to Canada. That's how I got involved. And that's when I suggested put North America into the name. So who were the first group of women that started it? You and who else?
And Chung Hang Giang and Natawan Lewis and very soon Rita Nagashima Brock joined as well.
So many of us Asian American, Asian women, theologians, and those in the ministry are so indebted to you and to those who have continued the work at Pan Autumn. So thank you so much for all that you do, because it is, you meet yearly, but you do other events during the year. And I know I did one Zoom talk on publishing. So I'm just grateful for the work.
And I also remember, you see, Grace, you were the coordinator when we had our Pan Autumn in Toronto.
And yeah.
Thank you very much. Many years ago when you were.
Yeah, that was, I think, 1998 or something. It was, yeah, because I don't know if I had a child at the time, but I know it was like really early on. And mm-hmm. I was so overwhelmed. And I think Wenin In helped me as a faculty advisor, but I was really so scared about it. But I thought it turned out well. Mm-hmm. And I'm just so grateful for Wenin In. I spoke at St. Mike's, and I haven't seen her since I left Toronto in 2004. But she came to my talk, and she hasn't even aged at all. So I was thrilled to see her last year. Mm-hmm. So all these connections that we made at Pan Autumn, so many of us are so grateful to you. So thank you for your work. And before we get into this one, I want to talk about your other book, Asian and Asian Women in Theology and Religion. That was published through Palgrave in our series with me and Joe Che called Asian Christianity in the Diaspora. Can you say a little bit about that? Because I want the readers to actually read that one and the main book that we will discuss today. So share us a little bit about Asian and Asian American Women in Theology and Religion.
Yes, Pan Autumn has published several books. So in this book, I invite the members of Pan Autumn to talk about several things, to talk about their intellectual journey, why they are doing the work that they are doing, because they are biblical scholars, theologians, ethicists, and practical theologians. And then I asked them how Pan Autumn or other Asian or Asian women's group have been helping them in their scholarship or in their ministry. And then the last thing they will talk about in their chapters would be their visions for the future of Asian and Asian American women's theology and ministry. And as you can see that, each one approached those questions differently. So it is almost like a tapestry or a mosaic of different perspectives and different opinions.
Yeah, it's such an important book. And I wish more and more people will read Asian American books and understand our writers and our perspectives. So thank you for that book. It's such an important book. And I'm just thrilled it's part of our series. So thank you for that book. So let's get into this new one. So this is then your 23rd book, Puylan?
Or something like that, you know.
That's amazing. I have to catch up to you. So this, the Anglican tradition from a post-colonial perspective. I must say, before I started the book, I didn't know much about Anglicanism at all. I have a lot of Anglican friends, and I've attended a lot of Anglican churches, but I didn't know much. So tell us how you began or why you thought this was so important.
I have taught a course that is critical issues in the Anglican Communion for a long time. And when I was teaching at my former school, Episcopal Divinity School, and currently at Canberra School of Theology. So when I taught that book, I introduced to my students many of those theologians and church leaders from the Global South. Because when we talk about the Anglican tradition, very often the books or resources will talk about the Church of England or the Episcopal Church, USA. But the Anglican Communion is a very big family. We are the third largest Christian family after the Roman Catholic and the Orthodox, and so then the Anglicans. And we have more than 85 million members throughout 160 countries in the world. So within this big family, we have multiple voices, and especially with the shift of Christian demographics, the Anglican Church now, the average, if we think who is an Anglican, it will be a Black woman in the African continent, in Sub-Saharan Africa. So it is no more a white person in the Church of England or the Episcopal Church. But my students did not know much because they did not have the opportunity to learn or to study the voices from the Global South. So because of that, I then thought it is also a very good time to combine my two interests. One is my study of postcolonial theory and theology. I have published several books on that topic. And then I have also edited works on the Anglican Communion. So I thought it might be a good time to put the two together to look at the Anglican tradition from a postcolonial perspective.
Well, I'm glad you did, because as I said, I didn't know much about the Anglican Church, so I learned so much about the Anglican Church. And you began the book by describing how Anglicans came about. So I'm sure many of the listeners, even though they may be Anglican, but many may not, will have a big interest about how the Anglicans came about, because it's not what I thought. So can you share with us how yes. Anglicans came about?
When we talk about Anglican, and then, of course, the term refers to something that is related to the English heritage. But the Anglican tradition obviously came about in the with Henry the Eighth playing a very pivotal role. But I always remind my students, in fact, the Anglican Church has a longer root because we also claim what went before Henry the Eighth, you know, as our part of our heritage. And then with the formation of the Church of England, it started a different trajectory. And because it was very much related to the state at that time. So for the Anglican Church, the relationship between church and state had been since the beginning a very crucial aspect. And then later, when the British Empire expanded and the Anglican Church also went to so many different parts of the world. And then when we formed the Anglican Communion, we trace it back to the formation of the first Lambeth Conference and since the 19th century. And so today, when we talk about the Anglican Communion, we really need to say it is beyond the so-called Anglo-Saxon captivity, because you have Anglicans in so many different countries, and some will say they will trace their background not from missionaries from England or Episcopal Church USA, but they were from maybe other African missionaries or other Latin American missionaries went to establish churches in other regions. So we cannot just say today the Anglican Church is defined by one culture, which is the English culture.
Mm-hmm. But you forgot to mention why King Henry VIII wanted to split from the Roman Catholic Church. I think you put it in the book. I thought that was the most important part.
Well, for some, it is the most important part. But for others, it might be of other circumstances at that time as well.
Yeah. So he wanted the annulment of his marriage and so forth. So I thought that was quite interesting how these denominations do rise up and how, I guess, different churches form. And when you think about all these other churches, even within the Presbyterianism, so many here in the U.S., why we split over different issues, it is quite interesting. So I really enjoyed reading that part of how Anglicans came to be.
Yes.
Yeah, and then because your book is tied up with post-colonial studies, you talk about how in also in Anglican, but in other denominations too, there's this sense of superiority of Christianity in their culture. Both English and colonial Anglicans created a binary between us and them, treating non-Christians as ignorant and pitiful heathens. Can you share a bit more about that? Because it's not just the Anglicans. We know other denominations, when they went out to different places to share the gospel, they all looked at Asians as heathens, and we were like, Koreans were so evil, shamanism, what are they doing? So share us a little bit about that, because the binary of us and them is still present even today.
Yes, this is precisely so. And you are absolutely correct. It is not only the Anglican missionaries who at that time harbored this will of the heathens, and then we are going to civilize them. We call it the civilizing mission. And the other missionaries, they may also share the similar understandings. And so when the first mission society, the SPG, the Society for the Propagation of Gospel, was formed in the early 18th century. So the formation had so much to do with evangelizing the so-called heathens. And so missionaries were sent to different parts of the world, to the Americas, and later, of course, to the other continents. And I was trying to understand, when this colonization process was going on, what did the church say? Did the church resist this expansion? Or did the church say, this is good for not only the church, but also for the British Empire? And so some of the rhetoric that was used during that time, you can unfortunately still hear what people will be saying today. That is the uniqueness of the Christian gospel and the others who are worshiping idols, that they cannot be saved unless they had the conversion. So I had this chapter that talks about mission and also interreligious solidarity to try to present a different understanding of Christian mission It is not assuming we have all the answer and to bring the truth to the heathens, but instead, this is a mutual partnership and carrying out the mission of God.
Do you think we could ever overcome this binary between us and them?
I think it's very difficult, and especially given today's political ethos. And even in the United States, you have the evangelicals whose voices are not only in society, but in politics as so strong. So I think that it is still a very long-term struggle.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing it out into the book, because that's so important. And some of us may not recognize that that binary exists, mm-hmm. but I think for you to point it out. You also talk about this crisis of Anglican identity, which can be attributed to many causes, because the Anglican Church do not have the equivalent of the Augsburg Confession or a body of official mm-hmm. doctrines, which may be present in the Lutheran tradition or in the Presbyterian tradition. So I don't know if you want to share anything about that, this Anglican identity crisis.
Yes, I think that this Anglican identity crisis has been there for some time. But today, because many of those former colonies have regained independence, and the Anglican Church in those independent countries formed their own province. And unlike the Roman Catholic Church, we did not have a central teaching office like we have in the Vatican, or with a very centralized curia. And for us, we keep asking ourselves, what is the boundary of this Anglican communion? Who can join or who cannot? For example, as you know that, for several decades, the Anglicans, like unfortunately other mainline denominations, have been debating on the question of human sexuality. So there would be people who say, those who follow biblical authority or interpretation as they define it, they can belong to the Anglican communion. Whereas others who do not follow what they call the biblical truth or the literal interpretation of the Bible, that they are not the true Anglicans. So there were many, many questions. And again, talking about Anglican identity crisis, what is the theological locus when we have debates on this issue or other issues? How can we adjudicate and to understand who has the authority? So a Christian Anglican identity has so much to do with the question of authority. And because we are a family of churches, and so sometimes things get very messy. And so we continue to debate not only over this issue, but other issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you say things get messy, because that happens in every denomination. And when we think about churches, just individual churches too, mm-hmm. things are so messy. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing that. Your book, because it's on post-colonial, you do touch on South Africa mm-hmm. and the apartheid, and you bring in Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu mm-hmm. and his work. So, you know, he really asserted moral and spiritual authority during the fight against apartheid. But we know that, you know, churches have said, oh, it's okay to have enslavement or apartheid or genocide. So how was his work impactful within the Anglican Church, his fight against apartheid? If you can just shed some more light.
Yes, and obviously it was very important to remember his witness and his testimony, especially during the apartheid years in South Africa. And then after that, we of course remember his role as the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And so he wanted to bring the country together and wrote books about forgiveness. And so he played a very important role during the struggle against apartheid, and also during the time when the country really needed spiritual leaders like him to bring the different sectors of the community together. But I also remembered the Archbishop was very outspoken on many issues too, sometimes quite controversial. So he certainly spoke against racism, and he also would say, if we stood up against the colonizers and the racist people, we also need to stand in solidarity with the GLPTQ people. And so he was very prophetic. And there was this journal of Asian studies who wanted to have a particular issue to celebrate his ministry and his life when he turned 90. But unfortunately, he did not see that issue published. But then I and my student co-wrote an essay that talks about his legacy. And we interviewed people or we asked people to contribute their memories of Archbishop Tutu. And so we heard from young people, from people who are fighting for different fights, and including the younger people in South Africa and also LGBT leaders, both in the United States and in Asia. So they spoke highly of his leadership and also his being a role model for so many of us.
Where is that article? Can we read it now? Or?
Yes, the article, yes, appears in the Journal of Asian Studies.
Oh, okay. So that's very interesting. I would love to read that article. So those who are listening to Madang, you can search that article and read it if you're interested on reflections, especially from young people on his work, Desmond Tutu. Yes. So Tutu also, he in his work, he evoked the idea of Ubuntu. So yes. You write about that too. So can you share with us, listeners? Some of us may be familiar with that, but many of us may not be.
Yes, it is a kind of African understanding of our relationship with others. And to summarize, we will say, I am because we are. We are part of a larger collectivity. It's not isolated individual. And so because of that kind of understanding and the African philosophy do not understand people as us and them, we are part of this larger human community. And that is why for the struggle of the South Africans, they are trying to create a community that can accommodate differences, that is not tearing each other apart, but to recognize I can only exist because collectively we have relationships.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And I think we don't have that term in Asia, but we may have similar terms like that. So, you know, the community is more important than the individual in a sense. So I thought this was really beautiful when you included that in your book. And to continue with Archbishop Tutu about forgiveness, I really appreciated that chapter. And you wrote that he pointed out that forgiveness does not mean forgetting the past, nor does it imply weakness. We forgive because God has forgiven us. I don't know if you want to say more about that, because that's really touching, especially for those people who feel wronged. Mm-hmm. And you know, how do we deal with this forgiveness? We hear a lot about it in our churches, but not so much in scholarship and in books as much, in theological books. So I was really happy that you included Tutu's understanding of forgiveness. Did you want to say a little bit more? And then you tied it in with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission too.
Yes, I think that it is so important to understand the relationship between forgetting and forgiveness. Those are not synonymous. And because when we heard those horrific stories coming out from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, then we say, how can we forgive? And should we just forget the atrocities committed on so many different people? To forget will erase the memory of those victims of history and society. We cannot forget, because if we forget, we have not learned the lesson. But on the other hand, the Archbishop has always been inspired by the Bible And then he said, the gospel is really talking about forgiveness, not forgetting. And forgiveness is to understand that we are not perfect, that we might have done something wrong as well. And to forgive is because we have been forgiven by God. And through the power of Christ's reconciliation, and we would be able to forgive. So forgive is really a very spiritual thing. It cannot be demanded. It can only be freely given. And so to forgive is really a gift to the enemy, right? And it is also a gift to the victim, that you might be able to close one set chapter of the history and not let them be a kind of woundedness that you carry on for the rest of your life without any resolution. So it is not forgetting, but it is a gift that we offered to the enemies or to the oppressor, and a gift that we offer to ourselves. I think that is a very profound spiritual lesson.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of an ongoing struggle for many of us. Mm-hmm. How do you really accept it as a gift and engage in this act of forgiveness that the gospel talks about so often? So thank you for sharing that. Now to get into you share a lot about how the Anglican Church is steeped in colonial history. So I don't know how much, I think the listeners, some may have some knowledge. I didn't have that much knowledge on this whole colonial past of the Anglican Church. I know in other denominations, it's still very present and clear. So I myself as a Presbyterian, but share with us, how it has been so steeped. You've kind of mentioned it right at the beginning too, but if you can say more about how the Anglican Church has been so steeped in this colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Mm. As you can see that, the Anglican Church is so much related to the nation. And because we have the monarch as the defender of our faith, right? As the head of the church. So it is quite particular. I know that other denominations, they have to write their own post-colonial history. But because of this very intricate relationship between the Church of England, the English society, and the power of the state, and that is why it is even more important to look at the tradition from the perspective of the oppressed and the colonized. And so in the 19th century, for example, in the middle of the 19th century, when we were then sending out missionaries or colonizing India and other parts of the world, within the Church of England, there were not much consciousness that this colonization project was something detrimental to the people and also to the land that the British Empire colonized. It was not until the later part of the 19th century, then people began to have more awareness, or you have the sense that church leaders would be saying something that is, let us also look at the imperial project and the devastation done to the colonized. So then slowly, there began this evolution of mentality of the church, and more people became aware that this colonial project could not continue. And of course, after the Second World War and the former colonies began to gain independence, then how would the church be organized in the post-colonial period? And that is why more and more we have scholarship on the struggle of the different churches. We have the monographs on different countries, Sierra Leone and the Burma or in other parts. So slowly now, when I wrote the book, I celebrated these emergent histories from the so-called peripheries, talking about the Anglican Communion, how they then became independent, and what were the issues that they faced, for example. And give the example of India. So India after independence, did not want to have the separate denominations. So some of the major denominations and joined together to form the Church of South India and North India. And so this is a form of their response to coming out from the colonial situation. There were also other churches that had to respond to the situation when we could not depend on the missionaries or the funding, for example, in the Church of China. And so after independence, in the post-colonial situation, many churches needed to then think about what should be the polity or the ministry of the churches in that era.
Wow. Thank you so much. It's like so interesting in the book. It's steeped in theology and history and, you know, world context. So thank you so much for that. Yeah. Also in the book, talk about this massive inequality of wealth and power in the world and how some Anglicans would like to see the birth of a new church. And I love the line, this line where the church can be more concerned about God's mission than policing sexuality.
Yes.
Because right now we know other denominations are dealing with human sexuality, and you know, the divide is going to happen, and it has happened in my denomination. So I just found that we should make like a little billboard, a church that is more concerned about God's mission than policing sexuality. So I don't know if you want to share more. How can we, the Anglicans who want to see the birth of a new church, what kind of a church do we want? Yeah, or are the Anglicans?
Unfortunately, according to some of the scholars who studied African Christianity, they have pointed out the African churches, they were not so preoccupied with sexuality until the 1990s, okay? And then you recall that at that time, talking about the Presbyterian Church, you had this big divide among the Presbyterians. I recall that you have the majority report, you have the minority report too, you know? And so the American mainline denominations were embroiled by this discussion of human sexuality. And so we had the culture war in the United States. And for some, some of the conservative American church leaders then exported this kind of cultural war to the African continent. And so there had been a lot of debate. And then in the news media, when you hear about this debate on sexuality, well, you have this big coverage. Okay, they are divided, they cannot come together. When we were talking about this group of South countries trying to gather together to then talk about poverty, oh, you have very little coverage because people say that this is not newsworthy or would not attract people. And so there is this lopsided view, oh, then the Anglican Church or the mainline denominations, they are only interested in human sexuality. Now that becomes a very narrow narrative that talk about such a long and complicated traditions. But there are third world or the leaders from the global south who will say, besides sexuality, can we talk about other aspects of our life and our mission? Shouldn't we be concerned about this growing inequality between the rich and the poor? And soon we'll be talking about climate justice. So some of the bishops, and they are called the green bishops, and together with the activists, they are pushing the church to recognize we really need to talk about this climate emergency. I know that you are very concerned about this topic and has written about this issue, talking about planetary solidarity. And this is so important for all of us.
Oh, thank you so much for mentioning my book, Planetary Solidarity. And I love that you guys are, the bishops call themselves green bishops. I haven't heard that term, but that is so beautiful. And, you know, there are really catastrophic justice issues that we need to deal with. But the churches, you know, the Methodist Church, too, they're dealing with human sexuality. But focusing on that. But thank you so much for sharing that. You also discuss about worship in a post-colonial way. And I thought that was beautiful. If you can share with us what it means to participate or lead worship in a post-colonial way, about baptism and about language and culture.
Yes, as you said earlier, we did not have a common confession. So many of the Anglicans will say, what bind us together will be almost a common liturgy, not exactly common, but we draw upon the Book of Common Prayer. And that is why it has been debated. That is how far we can deviate from the Book of Common Prayer. But then in 1989, the church in New Zealand, Otorea, and New Zealand and the Polynesian Church came up with a bicultural and bilingual Book of Common Prayer. So it was such a gift to the world because last month I had the opportunity to attend a meeting of the Anglican Indigenous Leadership Initiative. And the Maori people in Otorea, New Zealand, were our host. And we had Indigenous leaders from North America and also from Polynesia and other parts of the Pacific. So we used part of those prayers for our morning worship and for our Eucharist. And so it was a very moving experience to celebrate in that particular context. So now, imagine. Our Book of Common Prayer came from a very English tradition. Then the question for us would be, what would the liturgy be if you are not part of that tradition? So for example, the countries in Japan or in Brazil, right, and some countries in Africa have never been colonized by the British, did not have the English heritage as the main legacy for their church. And so would they be using the same prayer book, or should the prayer book be expanded? So I'm glad that the church in Kenya, the church in Brazil, the church in South Africa, as well as other churches, they have tried to revise or recreate their Book of Common Worship. So I learned a lot from this discussion, because unless we talk about contextualization of our liturgy, then we will still be using a basically colonizing book, right? So I'm glad that people are very serious thinking about what liturgy would look like in our denomination in a post-colonial setting.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. And I think, you know, as the colonizer, you create God as this supreme emperor too, and as Jesus. When we know Jesus was this homeless Palestinian Jew who roamed the earth, didn't have much, but we've, you know, a lot of stained glass windows and paintings picture him as a British or some European emperor. So thank you for sharing that. Another interesting part about your book was you had this whole section on polygamy and how the British missionaries really, you know, found it so troubling, and it was against Christianity. But the irony of the whole thing was that colonization actually increased the number of cases of Africans who had additional wives. So I don't know if you want to share with us how that happened and why that is important to us. I just found it very interesting.
I reminded the student, well, human sexuality has been the issue since the beginning of the gathering of the Lambeth conferences. And so it is not a contemporary debate. We debated about it for a long time. And I even asked my students why this is such a dividing issue. Why people will break away from the Anglican Communion if they do not agree in one way or the other. And I told them sexuality must be understood in a much bigger context. It's not just about what happened in the bedroom, right? Because sexuality has always been taken as an indicator of the cultural difference. And because the missionaries went to certain parts of Africa and Asia, and then they were not happy with what they were seeing, this polygamous marriage. So then there was this controversy whether polygamous people could be accepted as members of the church. That is, could they be baptized? Or because they have polygamous marriages, that they had to be rejected. This is controversial because, lo and behold, the rich and powerful, they afforded to have polygamous wives, right? So that means you will then make many people angry, especially those powerful local people. So on the one hand, the church would want to uphold monogamy. On the other hand, they could also understand it's very difficult to fight this very long traditions. Plus, what would happen to those polygamous wives? The church did not want to have divorce, right? Did not accept divorce. So would you just divorce them? And how could these women have a safe living environment? So then you have all this question going on, pros and cons. And there were people who said this is part of the African culture and it could not be changed overnight. And there were other people who said no. And so this has been debated for 100 years, okay? And then it was only in 1988 that it was decided this should be decided in the local situation, okay? But why that the colonizers, because they increased their livelihood, they make the people richer, they traded, you see, with these colonizers. So some gained more money, and so they could afford to have more wives. And so that was this irony.
Thank you for sharing that. I think I'm so glad to see the part where you included in 1988 the movement for ordination of women. So if you can just enlighten us on that process and how the church in different parts of the world are accepting the ordination of women.
Yes, very slowly.
Okay.
And I'm glad to tell this story because I said innovation or creativity often did not happen at the metropolitan center, but in the so-called peripheries. So it was in Hong Kong that the ordination of women first began in the whole Anglican tradition. It was in 1944 that Forrest Li Tim Oi was ordained a priest in China, because at that time, China belongs to the Southern Chinese diocese. So it was because of the expediency of the Second World War. And afterwards, the bishop who ordained her, Bishop Awo Hall, was under a lot of pressure. And so he did not ordain other women. But then later in 1971, the vicar of my church, when I was a teenager, was ordained. She was the Reverend Wang Xinyuan. She was ordained with Joyce Bennett, a missionary from the Church Mission Society in 1971. And then since then, other parts of the world began to ordain women in the Episcopal Church, 1974. So 30 years afterwards. So pretty soon, next year, it will be a big celebration, the 50th anniversary of the ordination of women in the Episcopal Church and 80th anniversary for the first women ordained. And then gradually Canada, New Zealand began to ordain women. And slowly people in the global south also, after much struggle, and then began to ordain women. So today we not only have women priests, we also have women bishops. The first one, of course, is Bishop Barbara Harris of the Diocese of Massachusetts. That was in 1989. And then when she was consecrated as a bishop, she invited Florence Lithium Oil to join the particular occasion. So it was a very important occasion for us to see the first Chinese women as a priest joining the installation of the first African-American women as the first bishop, female bishop in my church.
That is amazing. Thank you for sharing that kind of history and what has happened in your home country. So thank you so much. That's very enlightening to me. And as a woman ordained Presbyterian, that is so good to know. You know, women have been struggling. And I know the Roman Catholic Church, there are pockets of women ordaining themselves that are not being recognized by the Roman Catholic Church, but women do feel called to serve. And I'm glad that the Anglican Church has this long history and that you have lots to celebrate. So we know that colonialism is devastating. And, you know, you've written many other books. I've read most of the books that you've written, except for the ones in Chinese. I can't read Chinese. I can barely read the Korean. So, you know, your books are so, so important. And so are there any kind of, like, how can we engage in this kind of post-colonial work for those who may just have a little bit of interest, you know, because we know the devastating effects of colonialism in Hong Kong and India and other parts of the world, even present time today. How can we engage in this kind of work so that we can work towards liberation?
Thank you very much. I think that this is a very important question because even though this book is about the Anglican tradition, I hope people from other denominations or different traditions that they can also learn from it. Because as I have done for the Anglican Church, and other people can also write post-colonial history for the Presbyterian Church or the Methodist Church to see in what way the Church has been complicit with the colonizing project, or who are the people whom we can now reclaim as prophets of their time, that they would raise the issue of the devastating consequences of colonialism. And I think without knowing or examining our colonial legacy, we will just continue without that awareness. For example, many of our churches are still singing hymns written in the 19th century with this colonial mindset. And we just sing it. You may be in Korean, I in Cantonese or Chinese, but we just repeated what those colonial ideology has been teaching people. And so today, I think we need to have the decolonization of the mind. It started with then honestly looking at colonial legacy and trying to learn from the past so that we can live in the present and envision a much different future.
Thank you so much. You know, your book, even though it is the Anglican tradition from a post-colonial perspective, exactly what you said right now, many of us have are part of this colonial past, colonial present situation. And so thank you for encouraging us to examine our own denomination or our faith tradition, because some people have left the church too because of the evils of colonialism, of racism. You know, you talk about racism in the book and sexism, etc. You know, we can spend a whole weekend talking about your book, but I think it's so important. So I hope all the listeners will read The Anglican Tradition from a Post-Colonial Perspective by Dr. Kwok Pui Lan. And as you kind of told us, that we examine our own context, our own faith traditions, and see how we can work towards decolonizing our churches and especially our minds. Thank you so much. Did you want to share any last words of wisdom or your next projects that you are engaged in at the time?
Yes. About 2 decades ago, Bishop Ian Douglas and I co-edited the book that is called Beyond Colonial Anglicanism. So that was the first collaboration. And we are collaborating again after two decades because so much has changed. And so we are co-editing a book that is called Living Postcolonial Anglicanism. So we hope this will be another gift to our tradition and to see how the vision of postcolonial Anglicanism can be embodied.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Thank you so much for spending time on Madame Podcast. I know you're very, very busy. You're teaching and you're doing a lot of Zoom interviews at this moment. So thank you so much. I learned so much from your book and also just having this conversation with you. And I hope all the listeners will read this one and all your other past books. So thank you so much for coming on Madame Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
For a decade, at the beginning of the 21st century, a small group of pastors, missionaries, and theologians set out to change the church. They were mostly Gen Xers, mostly men, mostly white, mostly evangelical. They planted churches and wrote books and ran conferences. Please join Emerge Podcast, a homebrewed Christianity production, a crowd-funded podcast to preserve an oral history of the emerging church movement. In this multi-part series launching January 2024, hosts Dr. Tony Jones and Dr. Trip Fuller will journey through the electrifying, tumultuous, ever-evolving years of the ECM through interviews, stories, and opinions from some of the movement's pivotal figures. There will be live stream debriefs of the history, a private online community, and an emerging church movement library. Please join today. Go to www.tripfuller.com. Emory University's Candler School of Theology is offering a new certificate of inquiry with a series on Asian and Asian American Christianity. Join leading scholars Dr. Kwok Pui Lan, Dr. Maggie Lau, Dr. Suyam Park, Dr. Tao Seong Bianni Liu, and Reverend Mihi Kim Court as they explore Asian and Asian Christianity approaches to scripture and theology in this three-part series. All three courses, Asian and Asian American Feminist Biblical Studies, Asian and Asian American Study of Christianity, and Asian American Queer Theologies are being offered for $99, and scholarships are available for any interested participants. Please register at bit.ly/certificate of inquiry or email us at candlerfoundry@emory.edu with any questions or concerns. The mission of Faith and Community Empowerment is to empower faith community leaders to better serve underserved communities. FACE trains faith leaders, educates underserved communities, and provides advocacy so that the voiceless may have a voice. FACE started by helping the Korean American community. Hidden behind a model minority myth, the Korean American community is the most underserved ethnic community in Los Angeles. In 2016, FACE was invited to the White House in a discussion of how to empower faith communities to better reach out to underserved communities. FACE has expanded its programs to serve more communities, such as Hispanic community. Donations will help grow FACE programs to provide training, education, and advocacy. Please go to www.facela.org to donate. Who is God when we see God through the eyes of survivors? Many books have dealt with sexual abuse scandals in the church and the role of pastoral care for survivors. Others have provided liberative readings of biblical texts to support survivors of sexual violence. Surviving God takes a new approach, centering the voices of sexual abuse survivors while rethinking key Christian beliefs, starting from experiences of oppression, beliefs that contribute to oppression are challenged, and new, hopeful, and healing beliefs take their place. Please pre-order Surviving God, co-written by Dr. Susie Shaw and Grace Jisun Kim.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast.gmail.com.